It was a privilege to be asked to deliver this talk, first on general principle, but also because of the opportunity it's afforded me finally to take my tail in my mouth like some graying Ouroboros and impute a closed and symmetrical pattern to my critical career. Just over two decades ago, I was taking a holiday in Adelaide and heading for Alice Springs via the GAN, that overnight luxury train, after several weeks in Sydney where I'd been doing research on Patrick White. Having cluelessly checked my books into the luggage car and facing a 20-hour trip with nothing to read, I wandered into the chemist off the lobby of the Adelaide Railroad Station and spied a copy of Blood Meridian, the old Picador edition with the red cover, on the wire rack next to the hairbrushes. Funny how things stay in mind. I still remember that hairbrush. It was one of those plastic hairbrushes, like 10 bristles on it, all of plastic, long plastic bristles that looked like one of the old punji steak, you know, traps from Vietnam. And right next to it was Blood Meridian, and I should have been warned. McCarthy had been mentioned to me recently by an Australian friend who suggested that I read him. So I did, and here we all are. Given the theme of this conference, I'd like to talk about how two brilliant fictionists treat the subject of landscape. Let me say in advance that this is an enormous subject, since both Patrick White and Cormac McCarthy have no single, simple approach to the broader issue of setting of place of what has become fashionable to call terroir. I'll focus, therefore, on a particular set of techniques by which they postulate hostile wastelands and then interpolate their characters into it for the purpose of illuminating their personalities and spiritual states by a process of tribulation. Now, I'm well aware that Patrick White is not extensively read anymore, even here in his own country. He's become a classic, which is to say, appreciated in principle but not in practice. No literate Australian can be unaware of his importance, but there's not much expectation to understand why anymore. This is even truer of our non-Indigenous participants today. And since I'm addressing an audience I know to be steeped in Cormac McCarthy and likely to be unfamiliar with much of White, I want to begin by discussing White's declining reception. The reason I find most often given for his current eclipse is that White's complexities of style and theme demand more of his readers than those without some ideological impetus to put up with him are willing to expend. At the very least, I find it remarkable in an era of such aggressive queer theory discourse that the cause of Australia's most prominent homosexual author and only Nobel Prize winner has not been taken up in a far more public manner. And I think this is a damn shame, I really do. So I do hope that what I have to say will stimulate a little additional interest in Patrick White's work. I believe that if you have navigated the labyrinths of Cormac McCarthy's style and have emerged from the darkness of his vision with your enthusiasm intact, you'll find White's expeditions into many of those same regions commodious to your own styles of reading. At first glance, you would not think that much connects Patrick White and Cormac McCarthy in stylistic terms, but that, I think, ironically enough, results from looking past their wrought surfaces to the stylistic matrices from which each departs. I'm well aware of the irony of my contention here, of course. White's style is a Baroque and fanciful elaboration on the parlor English of high modernism, with its subjunctive clauses proliferating from its predicates like hydroxyl radicals. Yet McCarthy essentially performs the same sort of alchemy upon the simpler and more direct bedrock of what Shelby Foote, after H.L. Mencken, called the American language, using conjunctions, especially and, as White would extrude his phrases from the appropriate punctuation. I must say that I find it ironic that White should have begun his decline into popular disuse, supposedly due to his convoluted style, precisely at the same time when Cormac McCarthy was about to become popular with the publication of All the Pretty Horses. Wholly out of print in America, he was still hanging on in print in a variety of Picador paperback editions here in Australia. Most of all, though, what really links them is their shared preoccupation with the outsider and the misfit. the discarded ones and the misanthropes whose credo could be summed up as, you can't discard me, I quit. But you could say the same thing about both writers' most palpable precursors, respectively, Dickens and Faulkner. And incidentally, I bemoan the dearth, if not the absence of studies, of which I am so far aware anyway, of how Dickens haunts so much of Patrick White's social vision. Moreover, the ways in which both writers treat the marginalized objects of their humane concern can be sharply distinguished as well. Yes, I did say humane, by invocation of which, obviously, I reject the accusation that both writers gratuitously torment their characters. White, several critics have insisted, mythologizes or subordinates his subjects to theological principles like any good high modernist. McCarthy breaks them down to their elemental constituents and often deprives us of any privileged insight into how they bear their sufferings within their own consciousness. This, of course, is all a truism by now, but in most cases, this is much truer of McCarthy than it ever was of White. I'll return to this matter a little later. Since I was so curious about why the fashions that have marginalized White for reasons of stylistic difficulty should simultaneously valorize McCarthy for practically the same reasons, I reanimated my White studies by revisiting some critical texts about White, most widely regarded during the late 1980s and early 1990s. And this because that was just about the period when, immediately following his death, White was being read out of curiosity, but was also being neglected out of style and fashion, or beginning to be neglected out of style and fashion. I must say that the spectacle I would like to describe for you does illuminate what distinguishes the reception of White from the reception of McCarthy. Even taking into account the profound differences, cultural and political, determining the nature of that horizon of reception. It also reminds us, or should remind us, that a thoroughgoing sociology of literary critical communities has yet to be written. One of the first things I noticed was how irremediably White criticism had marinated itself in an unholy colloid of old-school formalism and the kinds of mythographic and Jungian criticism which in America and Europe were already well en route to obsolescence. This is not in any way meant to marginalize Australian critics, because European and North American explicators of White, like Lawrence Stevens in Canada or Rodney Stenning Edgecombe in South Africa, and the otherwise superlative Gordon Collier in Germany, were assiduously practicing the same critical cryogenics as their antipodean correspondents. Collier may be forgiven because of the sheer excellence and brilliance of his project, a massive stylistic explication of the solid mandala entitled The Rocks and Sticks of Words. If you're doing stylistics criticism and you want an exemplary model of how to do extended stylistics criticism of a work of fiction, I cannot recommend The Rocks and Sticks of Words by Collier highly enough. It is a remarkable achievement. With hindsight and allowing for the distortions of time, they appear to have sealed themselves into some kind of an exegetical immunodeficiency bubble that filtered out all but the tiniest particulata of post-structural heuristics. Admittedly, White's work, viewed as some sort of colonial outpost of high modernism transplanted to Australia from the parlors of Europe via the modernist meltdown known as World War II, invited such criticism. White offered a survival of high modernist modalities well into the late 20th century, while its founding practitioners like Joyce, Proust, Mann, and Faulkner had passed on at least a decade earlier. I would assert, however, that as some critics like Peter Wolfe in fact did note, although I'm not sure that they were always fully aware just what they were noting, there was a strong self-subverting element to White's mythography. So pronounced, in fact, that in the works of his latest period, he had entered solidly into the skeptical worldview that my friend David Holloway, in his own superb book, has identified in Cormac McCarthy's fiction as late modernism. Ultimately, as Wolfe has also noted, White's protagonists seem to reap little in the way of spiritual boons from their suffering, or at the very least, sustained insights that hardly lasted them long enough to benefit by them. The Tree of Man Stan Parker, for example, suffers a cerebral hemorrhage at the moment of his hard-won epiphany. Mordecai Himmelfarb of Riders in the Chariot attains mystical devikuth, which is the Kabbalistic term for attachment. Since God is wholly other, you can't merge with him, but you can attach, okay? Kind of like a lamprey or a remora or something. Just in time for his mock yet lethal crucifixion by his co-workers at the bicycle lamp factory. I'm not so sure, though, that Wolfe or any number of White's other critics understood the point that White was making about the usefulness, or lack of it, of illumination in situ. And I would suggest that, in fact, White's vision here is in many ways consubstantial with McCarthy's point about how vital small acts of kindness and charity are to sustaining human existence. Help with patching a blown truck tire, for example, in Cities of the Plain, or bringing food to an old hermit in Sutri, or saving near-dead stragglers in the desert with a revivifying paste of pounded locust pulp and blood meridian. These two are small things, what in the Kabbalah, Himmelfarb's realm, we might call nitzotzim, or sparks of divine light. Actually, I'm struck by how much less interested his critics were, and again, I mean worldwide, not just here in Australia, but White, I mean, in his text qua text, than in either psychoanalyzing White himself or building some kind of case against him personally, like family court prosecutors. It is true that White, with his self-revelatory pronunciations in his autobiography, Flaws in the Glass, and the oracular political statements of Patrick White Speaks, invited quite a bit of this lopsidedly personalized focus. McCarthy, of course, was far less public a man than White for much of his career, and his preference for privacy, not to mention his penchant for seeming to endow his characters themselves with as little of a visible inner life as possible, would have deflected, I think, much of this silly armchair psychoanalysis, even if the critical atmosphere into which his works were spalded, I've come to love that word, hadn't been so very much different anyway. McCarthy's recalcitrant privacy and the hermetically sealed inner worlds of his characters forced a solid base of textual criticism, while White, in his activism and irascibility, and the raw, bared psyches of his protagonists, invited biographical critiques. Among those biographically fixated critics, Lawrence Stevens and David J. Casey treated White's work like liturgical or therapeutic exercises, whose success as works of literature depended on how well they fulfilled the advanced expectations of their critical schemes. The most extreme case of personalized hostility was Brian McFarlane's hysterical denunciation of Riders in the Chariot, Inhumanity in the Australian Novel, which was published in 1977, in which he savaged White as cruel, appalling, and misanthropic for his derision and brutalization of his characters. I must confess that the entire discussion about a fictionist's so-called sympathy or lack of sympathy for his characters, one of the mainstays of bourgeois criticism, has always left me cold, and not much more than a corollary of the pathetic fallacy. It's difficult for this unreconstructed pro-structuralist to become indignant about an author's inhumanity to textual ignis fatui. We've seen how easily the Jungian approach, for example, reduces, or if we're being charitable to Jungians today, transmogrifies these humans into precipitates of mythic archetypes with no ontological footing. How you can be abusive or inhuman to mythic archetypes, frankly, eludes me. David Tacey, for example, insisted on denying the possibility of an actually exterior world, persistently returning nature to within the consciousness of White's protagonists as part of his Jungian ideological constipation. Acutely Jungian images always seem to fit the way a square peg will indeed fit a round hole whose diameter exceeds its diagonal. The approach suffers from an insistent inability or ideologically motivated determination to refuse to distinguish analogy from identity. In Tace's view, false teeth in a glass by the sink evidence the great mother in her devouring aspect, and a garden becomes a devouring matrix stimulating the mouth of what Casey calls the teeth mother, sucking and slurping meat off of chicken bones. Patrons in a hotel restaurant eating, would you believe, festoon a world full of, gives this quote from Casey, full of crushing and devouring shapes, all reflecting her own near extinction in the Matrix. He's referring to Theodora Goodman and the ants story here. Not satisfied to stop there, Casey reminds us, ever chasing that dominating bitch mother of white so critical to his homophobic analyses of the novel, that the symbolic false teeth of Theodora Goodman's mother in the ant story, quote, often are imaged inside the vaginal cavity. And by the way, note his use of the term cavity here when speaking of teeth. You have to wonder if he suffered a Freudian slip, right? Whereas vagina dentata, they suggest the potentially castrating aspect of the maternal source. Now, if every image of tongue, lips, and teeth suggests a vagina dentata to our critic, you have to wonder what he sees in the mirror when he shaves. When Casey suggests, now this is not, I'm not making this up. You read Patrick White, Fiction and the Unconscious. I mean, it's like some demented Disneyland, you know, criticism. When Casey suggests that Theodora's unconscious has taken her over and her world is now more psychic than real, he might as well be talking about the way he experiences the text. And as Walter Kaufman noted at the end of his section on Jung in his brilliant History of Consciousness series, a psychoanalyst who hasn't solved his own problems will talk about himself and his own problems, whatever else it is that he thinks he's talking about. Most of all, it struck me how in so much of the postmodern postmortem criticism following White's death, rare indeed was the essay or article that failed to invoke the shrinkage of his readership. You almost have to wonder how many potential readers these critics themselves convinced of White's encroaching irrelevance through the trickle-down effect by which scholarly discourse ultimately filters out into the popular arena. In an academic setting, the distinction between reading the novel and reading the critic on the novel, reading the critic on the novel often blurs. The confusion can become an unhealthy habit of mind that perhaps we ought to be more alert about and discourage as much in ourselves as in our students. Whereas all of these crucial stylistic distinctions, real or imagined, between Patrick White and Cormac McCarthy begin to dissolve, though, we can discern some real convergence between them in their treatment of the natural world and the idea of a frontier between orderly civilization and disorderly wilderness. McCarthy has lived on intimate terms with the land, both as a youth in eastern Tennessee, where he widely roamed the countryside and kept collections of fossils and minerals. White, on the other hand, was an habitué of the sophisticated London theater scene, but also a sickly youth beset by respiratory issues. He suffered from asthma his entire life. Although he spent 2 years working as a stockman on the edge of the Snowy Mountains in southeastern Australia and developed an affection for the land, he never felt that he was suited for rural life. Even so, White uncannily brings the rugged outback and dangerous tropical coasts of 19th century eastern Australia to life in some of his most memorable novels, especially The Tree of Man, Foss, and A Fringe of Leaves. Closer to civilization and his fictional suburb of Sarsaparilla in Riders in the Chariot, White vividly stages the shifting boundaries of wilderness and the imposed order of men as well. One critic noted that in White's descriptions of natural settings, he seemed to exhibit an all but molecular sense of what was going on inside the inanimate world, a world which White thereby animates. Cormac McCarthy, on the other hand, quickly became something of a darling of eco-criticism. His descriptions of the wilds of Appalachia or the wastes of the southwestern American and northern Mexican mountains and plains have been described as so vivid as to become, quote, characters in their own rights. I've disputed this way of regarding McCarthy's natural world before and will reaffirm my unease with it below. And this really, my basic objection here is that nature isn't motivated, nature has no personality, nature has no no imperatives, okay? And when you deprive a character of motivation, personality, and imperatives, you're not talking about a character anymore. Not, and even metaphorically, I find that, that discussing nature is a character, unless you've got, talking rabbits and birds and like Watership Down, you know, you haven't got a character. Both novelists share a penchant for the dark side of human and wild nature alike. I chose this topic because I had sensed early on in my studies of McCarthy that I had re-entered a terrain I had just left behind in my recent studies of White. This seemed like a good opportunity, however belated, to explore the rhetorical techniques utilized by these authors to, quote, get inside, unquote, the world at large, and exploit its attraction to the and the influence it exerts upon their characters. I'd like to compare a passage from each author. The first comes from Voss, in which the German explorer, based on the doomed historical figure of Ludwig Leichhardt and his party, approached the outback sheep station of Gildra. Here's the White passage. By now the grass was almost dry, so that there issued from it a sharper sighing when the wind blew. The wind bent the grass into tawny waves on the crests of which floated the last survivors of flowers and shriveled and were sucked under by the swell. All day the horses and cattle swam through this grass sea. Their barrels rolled and gurgled. All night the beasts were glutting themselves on dew and grass, but in the dreams of men, the waves of grass and the waves of sleep were soon one. Dogs curled in pockets of the grass, shivered and bristled as they floated on their own dreams. The band of sweating horses, straight mules, lowing, heavy-headed cattle, and parched, tingling men went on towards Gildra. By the time the homestead was reached, the western sky was blood red. The foreground had almost foundered, through which ran the figures of a number of individuals, if they were not animated, black sticks, to receive the reins from the hands of the new arrivals. Smoke was ascending and dust from the broad road the animals had trampled, together with the vapors of night. All was confused, nor did the approaching unity of darkness promise great consolation. And the next passage is from Blood Meridian, and this is a passage that's actually come up here on the screen and been referred to before, but I want to look at it from a slightly different angle. The Glanton Gang cross yet another in a seemingly interminable series of badlands in search of human prey. Crossing those barren gravel reefs in the night, they seemed remote and without substance, like a patrol condemned to ride out some ancient curse. A thing surmised from blackness by the creak of leather and the chink of metal. They cut the throats of the pack animals and jerked and divided the meat, and they traveled under the cape of the wild mountains upon a broad soda plain with dry thunder to the south and rumors of light. Under a gibbous moon, horse and rider spancelled to their shadows upon the snow-blue ground, and in each each flare of lightning as the storm advanced, those self-same forms rearing with a terrible redundancy behind them, like some third aspect of their presence, hammered out black and wild upon the naked ground. They rode on. They rode like men invested with a purpose whose origins were antecedent to them, like blood legatees of an order both imperative and remote. For although each man among them was discreet unto himself, conjoined, they made a thing that had not been before, and in that communal soul were wastes hardly reckonable more than those whited regions on old maps where monsters do live, and where there is nothing other of the known world save conjectural winds. They crossed the Del Norte and rode south into a land more hostile yet. All day, they crouched like owls under the niggard acacia shade and peered out upon that cooking world. Dust devils stood on the horizons like the smoke of distant fires, but of living thing, there was none. And as my esteemed constituents, ever alert, have doubtless noticed, these passages teem with common elements. Both settings are arid, In rhetorical terms, they are in a process of becoming more arid. The wind is drying the grass and forcing it to sigh, whether in pain or out of nostalgia for its fleeting deliquescence. Clouds of dust rise from the road and fulminate like a pall. In McCarthy's passage, the reefs traversed by the Glanton Gang are barren, and in the distance is a lightning storm apparently rainless. The land cooks in daylight, and their shade is meager, and again, dust and smoke hang in the air. You can practically read both of these narratives with your throat as well as with your eyes. Nothing stimulates one's deconstructive instincts like the illusion of rhetorical simplicity. Arid or barren land is one such figural illusion. I mentioned above that McCarthy and White shared a strategy of semiotic self-subversion, and of this, these passages are exemplary. McCarthy and White both open space between oppositional terms which they inhabit with a vigorously disseminating semiosis. Counterpoised to the primary scenarios of desiccation, we find marine imagery and plenty of it. In the Slog de Gildre, this marine imagery assumes a nearly equal stature with the dry prairie setting. The grasses form waves which swell, upon which dreaming dogs float, which sucks down dry flowers like a riptide, and through which men and cattle swim. The Glanton Gang in turn crosses reefs and rides past capes, and the ground is snow blue. This latter image is charged not only with the color of water, but with the image of snow, in further opposition to the sense of withering heat pervading so much of the passage. Of course, in the cultural subconscious of both national dreams, if you will, the invocation of the sea suggests other more primal passages through which both nations were founded or colonized. And in both cases, the expeditions underway represent the further extension of the colonizing process into the empty spaces, the whited spaces, if you will, of terras incognita, in the process of being named and known. At the same time, in the welter of maritime images in both passages, the sea acts as a symbol of emptiness, of an ultimate peeling away or evacuation of the riders and their animal companions, playing off the antinomial imagery of desiccation. The waves suck down, permeate, and overmaster the consciousness of men and dogs alike in the trek towards Gildre. Or perhaps it might be more accurate to say that the waves represent the subsumption of the rational mind into the flux of the unconscious, of the dream, as if these sailors upon the land in their odyssey into the unknown interior of the continent, in response to the sighing of the grasses, had succumbed to the song of sirens. And the Glanton Gang's collective unconscious, too, participates of those whited regions on old maps, which, if you can envision those antique charts for a moment, inevitably display an Homeric scenario of krakens, whales, and other mythical sea monsters spouting water and entangling vessels in their tentacles. By the way, just occurred to me that this isn't the first time that McCarthy, well, pardon me, it's not the only time McCarthy does this, because one book later in All the Pretty Horses, when John Grady and Lacey are on their way to Mexico and they're looking at a map, Lacey looks at this map with all of its whitest spaces and he says, "There ain't shit down there. You know, there ain't shit here either." The heat, the sun, the dryness, as well as the motion of waves contribute to the paring down or peeling away of the living subjects, objective correlatives for the self bared to the weather and environment. Thelma Herring, among others, has noted that in White, civilization is an unfortunate accretion which must be stripped away in any quest for personal authenticity, so that the drying out of the grass with its sighs of pain or of nostalgia for the lost inauthentic self become actually audible, the rising of a spiritual process to the level of material sensibility, if you will. Note, though, how hermetically sealed each man is in the Glanton party, complete unto himself, yet combined they make a thing of collective wastes, the writhing monsters of the inhabited by the rising monsters of the unconscious. From the eco-critical perspective, this paring down also has the effect, as both Dana Phillips and John Beck have noted, of establishing equivalency between protagonists and their settings, as though they had been reduced to the same mineral components of the terrain that they transit. McCarthy does not grant us direct access to the thought processes and emotions of his characters. Instead, his description of the environment supply equivalencies to the personalities of the gang members, with the unmapped land suggesting the unself-consciousness of each man, the monsters, the mindless violence which broods not just within the kid, but within all of them. If McCarthy usually encloses the inner lives of his characters, he never skimps on endowing his settings with an élan vital that animates even the most stolidly inanimate of objects. Allowing for the anomaly of Sutri, and especially Sutri's typhoid hallucinations, he uses vignettes out of nature and the environment to emphasize his anti-hero's frame of mind. When Sutri awakens in a vacant lot following one of his benders, McCarthy emphasizes his wretchedness with an image of small birds on a telephone wire framed by a glaring sun squeezing, quote, foul yellow mutes from beneath their fanned tails, unquote, apparently all over him since he is looking straight up into their vents. If there is a more evocative description of a hangover anywhere in literature, I have yet to come across it. Even when he treats us to an interior monologue, in particular the first-person narrative of Ed Tom Bell, which takes up large segments of No Country for Old Men, he details an unfolded consciousness with an exterior object. In Bell's case, the crude stone drinking trough next to a French farmhouse. And it occurred to me, by the way, and I should have written this in a previous essay, and I just only caught up with this last night when I was proofreading this. That stone trough now strikes me as the equivalent of the golden bird, you know, the hammered gold bird of hammered gold and gold enameling, at the end of Sailing to Byzantium, the poem from which McCarthy took the title to this. And an old friend of mine, a wonderful, wonderful poet, no longer with us, unfortunately, Michael Donaghy, in his Whitbread Award-winning collection of poems, Shibboleth, began a terrific poem called A Miracle, with the line, get the bird of gold enameling out of the living room. I'm reading. Find that book, Shibboleth. Phenomenal collection of poetry. Bell, too, is being pared down. His quiet conservative idealism has been eroded by the viciousness and violence he has witnessed, so that seeking some vision of solidity and permanence as his ideologically constituted world crumbles, he takes comfort from the memory of a boulder hewn like some primitive baptismal font. Please pardon me one of those free associations which are the sources of our greatest pleasures as readers. But that trough, as a suggestion of redemption, reminds me an awful lot of the glass on the piano at the end of Baldwin's Sonny's Blues, which shook with Sonny's playing like the very cup of trembling. White's technique is a bit different, but he wields his earthly metaphors to similar ends as corrosive disclosures about his protagonist's emotional and spiritual states. In Fosse, White often uses mineral imagery to describe the qualities of the German explorer's personality. He's variously described as, quote, a crag of a man, unquote, and quote, glittering like a quartz or diamond, hard as stone in his overweening egotism and Nietzschean self-satisfaction. He sets out as the very personification of the qualities of the land he challenges, unyielding, tough, and enigmatic. Against his adamantine ego, the outback works its relentless abrasion, even as his self-mystifying love for Laura Trevelyan grows to fill the evacuated hardness and egotism. His death, when it comes, is inflicted in typical Whitean fashion, just as he has learned to accept his vulnerability when his aboriginal guide stabs him through the flesh, which has become soft and yielding. I want to emphasize in closing now that I don't think that this view of how White and McCarthy exploit their wasteland mise-en-scenes is amenable to an eco-critical interpretation. The representations of the natural world as described here are really imaginings of unnatural worlds, or perhaps I ought to say unnaturalistic worlds. Despite the wealth of concrete detail, they are really mirrors of the spiritual and psychological states of the protagonists, more like holographic objectifications of inward conditions than true phenomenological environments. Whereas there are certainly other instances of descriptions of nature realized by both authors independently of their protagonists. In the particular instances I've been discussing here, the landscape is, effectively, the inner life of these characters turned inside out. Yeah, thank you.